Clubhouse.
This is Paul.
This is Caroline.
And this is Mike. Welcome to the Third Day Podcast. Tonight we're talking about episode one of the Third Day, Friday, The Father. This is a weird little limited series HBO is doing. This, you know, people talk about event TV guys, but this is like real event TV that they've set up here. What do you guys think? This is kind of crazy, right?
It's definitely a niche show. There were qualities of it that reminded me of the first season of The Leftovers, a little bit of the way that it's shot, but not precisely, but some of it, and just sort of that weird other sense of there's a lot more going on than you're being exposed to in the first episode, which is true for all TV shows, but more so for shows like this.
I have felt very British to me. I think by saying that, we're saying kind of the same thing. It had a real, even like if you ever watch like Broadchurch, like David Tennant's Broadchurch, there's a real ambiance, a real vibe to the whole thing I associate with British drama. And this felt a lot like that too. What'd you think, Caroline?
I have not watched a thriller / mystery show in a very long time. And so for me, I was really excited to get a chance to have this sort of like, let's try to untangle what in the world is going on here exactly. I haven't watched one of those in a while. And so I was pretty much all in, people.
Just to give a little background, the series was created by Felix Barrett and Dennis Kelly. This first episode, I think actually all three episodes, the first three episodes were written by Dennis Kelly and are going to be directed by Mark Mundin. All kind of theater guys. Paul, what do you have on the theater guys here?
They've been in business for about 20 years in a theater production company in London. So if you're not in on the London theater scene, you might not know these two guys. But they're hooked up with Plan B Entertainment, which you do know. That is Brad Pitt's company. So when you on that screen, when you see Brad Pitt and those two other names, Dee Dee Gardner and Jeremy Kleiner, they are co-presidents of the company that he is CEO of.
Interesting.
Yes. And if you run down their filmography, they don't fuck around.
They
get nominated a lot for Best Picture. They make films that are very well thought of, Plan B Entertainment. So the fact that they got into business with these guys that are pretty unproven, I would say, on the film TV track, I think says a lot about their faith in the project.
This is a really unique project, though. Like, can you explain, Mike, a little bit how this show is rolling out?
It's a six-part television series, a six-part limited series. It's going to be split up into three episodes, which features Jude Law as the star. It's what they're calling the summer season. Then there's going to be the fourth week will be a televised, I think actually it's on a Saturday. It's a televised live theatrical event. I think it's 3 hours even, which will bridge the summer season, the Jude Law portion, together with the back three episodes of the limited series, which is going to star Naomi Harris. And that will be the winter. And the theater event will be what they refer to as the fall. So the theater aspect is kind of a connecting piece, but then it's also telling its own independent story in this kind of anthology story within a story. So it's kind of original and kind of piggyback on what Paul said. This is a lot of money. I mean, you're paying Jude Law money. You're doing it on HBO in connection with Sky Entertainment in England or Great Britain. And yeah, for guys who have never done television, it's kind of crazy to me anyway.
It's a fascinating way to roll this out. I think that there's a lot to this that will be interesting to see if anybody else grabs it up as an idea.
Well, the numbers are out for the first episode. About 200,000 people tuned in for number one.
Yeah, it wasn't well promoted. I mean, we happen to know about it because we pay attention to these kinds of things coming out. But I don't think it got a lot of press attention at all, which is weird because in this fall season, in this September, there's really not a whole lot of new things coming out. So you think it would have gotten a lot of attention.
It's not a HBO Sunday night show, if that matters. But
That's true. In my mind, that is true.
That does matter.
Well, it says something probably on the part of HBO, you know, that they're putting it on a Monday night. It's a really weird placement. I'm trying to think of Monday night shows. I know HBO has had Monday night shows. It's their other night besides Sunday that they put shows on. But yeah, it's not one of their flagship spots for sure.
Let's see. You want to talk about some other just sort of filmmaking kind of stuff. I found some of the cinematography stuff to be just some of the hottest shit I've seen in a while on film. I'm looking at the cinematographer, and I can't pronounce his last name, unfortunately. It's Benjamin Kraken, maybe?
Release the Kraken?
No, it's K-R-A-C-U-N. So I'm sorry to say I don't recognize his work, but I don't know if you know, Caroline, but there's a specific job in camera operator world called focus puller.
Okay.
That guy's job is just to get things in and out of focus on cue.
Huh.
Yeah. Watching.
That's like where if like Jude Law was in the foreground, really close to the camera, and then all of a sudden the camera moves, and now you see very clearly what's behind him, way behind him, and then it pulls back to his face, and he becomes blurry, and then it pulls back to his face in focus.
As if that ever happens in this show.
Right.
Well, I appreciate that there's an actual job that does that, because this show definitely had a style to it that cannot be denied.
They might have hired the world champion focus puller.
might have for
this show.
I mean, a lot of the camera work. I mean, not only did they pick a beautiful location to shoot in from literally the word go, from when he's in that, they have the oversaturated overhead shot of him talking on the phone with his car kind of pulled off, and then it's in the dark woods that's just kind of full of life as the Florence and the Machine song comes on. And then OC, which is a real place and just kind of idyllic. It's literally this world set apart by rising tides. You know, I think they made the absolute most of it. But there were a couple of shots where it looked like it was a painting that he would then begin moving through, which was, I have never seen anything like it before. In particular, there's a shot in the forest where he hears the sound. It's after his crying jag, and he hears the sounds of the kids. He's like still for a second when the camera first like gets to the shot, and then he begins to move, but the it looks almost like a Munch painting behind him, and he's just kind of walking through it. It was surreal. It was very, very trippy, and there's a lot of trippy camera work in this whole show.
Yeah. And like another painterly shot is even just the opening shot, just that overhead of the street that he's on. They replay kind of that overhead point of view, especially when it has to do with roads.
Yeah.
Whether or not they're covered up with water or not, that's another thing. But that's a shot that plays throughout.
I super appreciated the color and the way that they adjusted the color. I thought that the way that Jude Law's eyes really stood out, and then you could find that color all around him because they would extra amplify that. And then there was this kind of red color that also was really sharp and just really contrasted everything. I mean, it was visually very stunning.
That process is called color grading. And I agree. It stands out. The greens, and it's like a rust.
Yeah.
It's not like the exact opposite color on the color wheel. It's some other kind of, you know, molested version of that color.
Molested?
Yeah. Just the rustiness kind of made it feel dirty.
Well, even the tree bug, like a cricket, I've never seen anything that color before. But again, it was that kind of red, orange, kind of like a burnt sienna. Which you can never get enough of talking about burnt sienna.
Never.
And it almost looked like Richard Attenborough was about to start narrating the clarity and the kind of detail on it. It was pretty impressive.
Yeah, it did have that sort of nature film vibe.
But then Jude Law comes through, you know.
Right, and we're like, what are you doing, Jude?
Now, I don't know how much Jude Law you guys actually watch, but I was a big, big fan of him from HBO's The Young Pope and then The New Pope. And this is as different a character as you possibly can get. Maybe not as different as maybe Albus Dumbledore from Fantastic Beasts, which is where probably a lot of people for some reason know him from. But yeah, it's just kind of a chameleon role that he's doing here from the new Pope anyway, which just concluded earlier this year.
I go back to town to Mr. Ripley, son. I don't know what you're talking about, Albus Dumbledore. That came out like last year.
I was talking for the younger people. Well, interesting, because The Talented Mr. Ripley is another movie that I associate with really stark camera work. maybe Jude just likes dealing with like avant-garde camera work.
He's not afraid to get the camera right up in his face. Caroline goes, oh, he looks so old. I'm like, what are you talking about?
That's a bit much. I was just saying that.
This is a handsome man. What are you talking about? He looks so old.
He is handsome. I just feel like no one needs their pores focused on at that level. That's
well,
all I was
well,
saying.
Well, here's the thing. Well, Caroline, I would point you to the new Pope and all the promotional work. I would point you to the latter half of the opening credits that they used in that show, where he's walking in a Speedo, like a real banana hammock, and his junk is just flapping everywhere. And sure. And he's completely jacked. Like, his, I mean, for... He's beyond dad bod, yeah.
Here's the thing. but I think they made him here.
Well, no, they made him look kind of like schleppy here.
Full
to
on
his personality. Like,
I've just been living in the British Isles.
Schleppy.
Not keeping track of my appearance per se.
I thought he just looked like a normal person, which is what he should look like, an ordinary man, right?
Well, I think the show kind of picks up in media res in the middle of like a real grief moment for him, right? I mean, he's going into that. He's going to inflict pain upon himself because it feels good. Because it feels necessary. So I think he looks like a guy who is going through that kind of process. This show has a lot of questions to it for me, but also has like a lot of symbolism. I mean, just the title alone is heavy with symbolism. But I don't know where you guys even want to start. Do you want to start the woods and the river and Florence and the Machine and Dog Days Are Over?
Yeah, for sure. Like we've talked about with the camera tricks already, with the focus and the manipulation of the background, and with the Florence and the Machine, what we're hearing, these are all cues to me as, you know, a very experienced television watcher, that what we're seeing and hearing, especially when we're in Sam's POV, which is all the time, I don't think I can trust it all the time when it's so stylized like that.
But at the same time, I feel like as we were just beginning this episode and we got to the stream, and I could tell that the little tiny shirt he was holding was obviously, you know, the embodiment of all this grief that he was holding. It's hard. We had that split second moment of actual crying out loud, the screaming of guilt of grief and sadness. I felt like
maybe guilt. Yeah. I don't know that guilt is off the table when you hear some of the conversations that he has. So
I completely agree.
That might have been an on-the-nose Freudian slip.
Probably. But I definitely felt that as a parent who has experienced grief probably above and beyond maybe just like an average existence, you can almost feel like you get lightheaded. And that was what I was experiencing when I was seeing this out-of-focus scenery all around him. I've had moments where someone has had to tell me some sort of news concerning my children where I felt like my blood pressure just like shot through the roof. I could hear like blood in my ears and I couldn't think. I literally couldn't think. And if I had to put that in a visual format, this is what it could have looked like. So it didn't feel out of line to me or untrustworthy so much as just the visceral feeling of grief in a visual form.
Let's put on our Sherlock Holmes hats here and try and figure out why we're at the river here to begin with. I think we all agree he's had a child who's died, probably a son. I'm thinking the son that he refers to several times is he has two girls and a son. I don't know that son is still alive. I feel like that's the son who he's here to grieve over. Where do you guys think on that? Am I reaching?
I found it odd that he consistently said, I have three children, two girls and a boy, because I actually have the same and I never say that. I say I have three children, but I never say I have three children, two girls and a boy. And he said it, I think, no less than five times in this episode.
Right. And I think that's a boy's shirt he sends down the river, which
for
made
sure.
me think that the boy is, I had three children, two girls and a boy.
That was a distinction that Caroline picked up that I did not so much, but when I think about it, I also behave the same way. I don't give all the deets unless someone starts probing beyond that. They're usually good just to know that
I have three kids, right?
Yeah.
To be fair, I don't know any human in the history of the world who's ever given more unsolicited information than Sam, who's got to keep his shit a little bit more tight. I mean,
we all know about Ade, bro. I mean, come on now.
He has some moments that of just verbal diarrhea where he just, you're like, why is he saying
you think that's
unstable? I think he's unstable. I think he's unstable.
But I'm going to back up and say, if you are in that level of grief, which he seems to be, that shirt was was small, guys. It was a shirt. I mean, I feel like this child was little, young.
You had no time with that child, right?
Mm-hmm. There
was no
time. And this is so he may say things, he may blurt out things that seem like TMI, but I've actually been in waiting rooms where people blurt out their friggin' life stories, or, you know, to the point of being kind of out of it, you know, just not quite all there.
Do you think that just like how there are differences between stage acting and film acting in terms of being able to deliver emotion through nuance, is it conceivable that the writing also, the way that they kind of give these expository verbal vomits in order to have Sam explain all this ad A stuff to people that he shouldn't be telling a word of it to. Do you think that's just like a byproduct of their most the writer's comfortable writing, you know, headspace?
Like, because they come from a theater background?
Yeah. Theater writers transitioning to TV are in their comfort zone by over-explaining shit, because you probably got to do that in theater writing anyway. You got to act big. You got to explain big because the audience is too far away.
I have in my notes a lot of places here struck me, especially when it was two people, especially like the scenes with Mr. Martin and Sam, and then Sam with Jess later on. A lot of the pub scenes were very play-esque in their dialogue, in their staging, the turns of the body, the distance between the characters. A lot of it felt like I was watching a play on film.
Which I actually enjoy quite a bit. Like, I love the Golden Girls, and they have that exact same feel of like walk in, start scene, say words, play for a laugh, or play for the climax moment, and then like exit stage left. Like, it's all very choreographed in that way, and it did feel that way. But at the same time, I was there for it, because I feel like as we get into this more, but the island itself, I was happy for it to kind of play out a little bit odd in terms of the way that people act on it. So even to the point of the way that they interact with each other, for it to look more like theater set rather than the way we normally act, feels like, yeah, that seems on point for this place because it's so odd.
Isn't that kind of an interesting thing that happens with people when they move from kind of one comfort zone or writing style or medium to another? Like, we noticed with the Gilmore Girls, for instance, when they moved from network TV to the Netflix show, Caroline, how they took advantage of the money and they were able to do much cooler camera moves and they had more fun with the way the things were shot.
Yes.
I think these guys might be guilty, and that's not the right word, but
indulgent.
There you go.
They were taking a dip in Scrooge's money vault.
I think so. Yeah, you got it. You got it.
So let's talk about some of the symbolism in the river scene, because I think it comes back to play again, especially with Mrs. Martin. You know, Caroline, you hit on it, that whatever he went through, it seemed like it was some kind of tremendous grief, and a small child is going to evoke that kind of emotion. But whatever it was, he was on TV at some point talking about whatever happened to his child, making a plea, we don't know the circumstances, but it was a significant story, at least to the point where it reached the television sets of the residents of OC, which don't seem to be the most clued in technologically. So the fact that they caught Sam's story on television where Miss Martin knows him from, it seems like it was a significant event, whatever happened. The idea of rivers are interesting because a lot of times they symbolize the passage of time. They symbolize life. They're heavy in the Bible. They're heavy in mythology. There's a Celtic myth about the River Ribble.
River Ribble.
River Ribble, yes. It's, it actually is a northern English river that runs into, I guess, Ireland and or across the river, and it terminates there. Anyway, the Celtic myth is that the river requires a sacrifice every 7 years.
So it's a Protestant river.
Well, there's a lot of Celtic references, even the mention of the Druids and
right.
the, you know, Eases. Stonehenge. And then Epona, that's a Celtic reference. Yeah, so I thought it was just interesting that we're at the river here. It requires a sacrifice. He's at the river kind of commemorating the passage of time with his son's death. Someone was working off of a plan here. I was setting us up for we're entering this kind of new world. Let's talk about the first time he sees Epona and the mysterious boy in the red shorts. Is that boy really there? Is that a figment of his mind? Is that his dead son? Is this son, Sam's son, come back to life as some kind of guide for him?
He's constantly denied for the rest of the episode in terms of that someone else was could even have been there. But, on the other hand, someone tied off that rope. So, I don't know.
How did Ipana even get to the island? How did this young girl get off of the fucking island that's impossible to get on or off of and get into the woods on mainland England? A lot of good questions around that, the how did this happen.
Yeah, especially like it seems like that that internal timer that the OC residents have for when the causeway floods over again. I don't think that that's actually legit. Or maybe the right way to handle it is just not a way that people think about in terms of like, oh, it goes away at a certain time. That means it's gone at that time. You have to cross before
you're speaking
that.
Speaking of a specific moment when Aponia says, the causeway, you need to be there by 3:50. And yeah. it's like 3:52 and it's fucking closed.
And
like,
I'm saying,
there's no way that happened in 2 minutes, Aponia.
And I'm saying someone without a command of causeway knowledge would have a hard time getting from one side to the other. That's my argument.
I thought it was funny when he was on the island and he was like looking out over the edge of his hood of his car. He's looking to the sides, like worried about because of the S turns on the causeway. And she kind of goads him a bit. She's like, "You're not gonna fall off." I was like, bitch, I'd be the same way. This is a crazy little thing you're having me go across.
There's potholes everywhere.
Yeah.
And yes, you definitely can fall off.
I mean, and the ocean's on both sides.
It washes away a little bit more of the surface every time it comes in and out. Goodness.
But the island OC actually really does disappear. The causeway really does disappear with the high tide. It seems like a crazy thing to fit into this crazy world, but it's actually a legitimate thing that really happens in real life.
The only other time that I've ever seen that in anything was a Daniel Radcliffe movie. It was like he had to go to some haunted house or some shit, and he had to ride a coach to get there. So it was like old timey, and that kind of stuck in my mind. Like, what modern place that's still worth going to would put up with a rope that disappears half the time?
The way that OC is used currently, like, is it's all about exclusivity, and like the rich and famous are the people who do access this island. It is in use. You can rent the entire island currently. And the idea that the road washes away, or I shouldn't say that, the idea that the road is just covered up for whole periods of time, there's a little bit of like a danger to that, a little bit of a mystique to that, and kind of like a sexiness to that. Like, here I am. No, I'm not. Here I am. No, I'm not. What a sexy road.
Minx.
It's almost like a forbidden fruit kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, the island only lets you have it when it wants you to have it. You just can't go fuck the island, right? The island says, oh, no, my causeways are closed. You have to wait for me to be ready to open them again.
It's a coquettish island.
It's coquettish. Let's call it that for the rest of this time. Totally agreed. Well, you guys, I have to say, okay, I need to put this out there for our listeners because I am a scare baby, you guys. I'm a wicked scare baby. I have a really hard time with things that are like jump in the night kind of things, okay? That's not the right words. Things that go bump in the night. They scare the hell out of me. So we got to go back to those woods.
They do all sorts of friggin' things.
Here's the thing, though. Yeah. We got to go back to the woods. And the first minute we meet Aponia and that whole moment, you guys, I pretty much leapt off the couch. Like, when it actually happened, when it caught her neck, I leapt probably 3 feet in the air and was scared shitless.
The Foley artist earned his paycheck with that snap sound.
That snap sound, yes.
And obviously not her neck, right? Because if that was really her neck making that sound, she would not have come back to life. That's a whole other kind of question, right? But which we can get into for sure. I think there's some question marks around Epona and life and death and what she really is. But I think it's the branch. But yeah, no, I agree with that snap. Is like blood curdling when it happens.
Paul, he was around. What did I do?
You covered your face and you kind of kicked at me because I had seen it before you, and I was supposed to report in terms of what would scare you, and I thought something else later would scare you, but it turns out this was the thing. So yeah, it was part face cover, part kick at Paul.
I was really scared.
So let's talk about Epona, though. So Epona is the Celtic goddess. It was the patron of horses. Was eventually adopted by the Romans as one of their kind of gods, goddesses. But it originally started out as a Celtic goddess for patron of horses, but is also associated with being the patron of fertility, rebirth, and abundance. Interesting things that are going on at OC with abundance and the sea and the soil and the festival, and they need it to go well. The miscarriages, the 7 miscarriages of the Martins and rebirth and life. I also thought it was kind of like a little dig because she had some British teeth wear, and I'm hesitant to make fun of a child or criticize one, but she had kind of like big horse teeth. So it was kind of funny to me that Epona was the patron goddess of horses. So I thought it was like a little dark dig because I'm a horrible person that made me laugh. Those ligature marks that she has on her neck the rest of the episode, I don't know that Epona is really alive before or after her hanging. I don't know if the little boy that we see is really alive. Did you guys doubt the lifeness of any of these characters at any point?
I won't admit to feeling that anything about the lifeness of them. I did get an instant feeling of this is going to be one of those shows where everything that she is saying to him right now that seems mysterious, you know, about like the festival and soil and salt and those monsters with the scissors and shit. Once we see the whole show, everything that she is saying is going to have a second truth to it that's not apparent just in that scene.
Mr. Martin as well. He's also a double talk.
Yeah, there's got to be some reason why that guy is constantly smiling and say, oh, he's not a bad guy. Everyone that we meet is a bad guy.
Mike, did we just, like, Mr. Martin just, like, stepped in here just now? That was...
He did. He did. It was freaky. I didn't realize we had a guest on this episode.
Yeah. I didn't want to...
Patty Considine, so glad to have you here. Thank you for coming on.
So, agreed. And also her behavior, though. I mean, obviously, that entire scene with the hanging. But then also when they're riding in the car and she just, like, goes to sleep. That was, like, so weird to me. The whole experience there was so odd. There was a lot of parts about her that was like, this kid, she ain't your normal kid.
No. And those, I keep going back to like the deep ligature marks on her neck. That is not someone who is okay. No matter how you breathe life back into her, and he doesn't really do CPR on her.
Yes.
He just kind of yells and flaps his wings like a scared chicken.
But hold up too. You know? I don't know very many people who would have handled it the way he did. And guys, I've never been in this situation, but the way that he somehow managed to untie the rope off of her neck seems implausible.
Gets her off of her neck while smushing his face in her bosom.
Catch the bosom portion.
He's not a terribly big guy, you know?
It was disturbing how smushed he was in her, like, chest area. The whole thing was very odd and disturbing, and I watched the episode a couple times, and every time it did not feel good to me. It felt
I just didn't think that, like, really using physics, like, I didn't think that you could, like, walk up that sandy hill the way he was and lift her heavy body, which honestly probably weighed equal to him, untie that noose that would have been really, really tight because her whole body weight would have pulled on the rope.
Yeah,
right.
I was like, how did he untie that?
She's got to let him fudge it on that because I agree.
Unless you go back to the idea that, no, she didn't really make it. Because you know what I'm going to point to? The scene where Mr. Martin goes, you saved her, but you saved her as if he didn't save her. He never had saved her.
There's a lot of that. I focused on that scene where Mr. Martin, because Paul, you were just talking about how effusive he was all the time. That scene was
very effusive.
It was even, it was like plus 10 though for him, because he goes in the same line where he says, but you saved her, you did your thing, and which is not what he was talking about at the time. Mm-mm. He was trying to talk about how we need to get off the island, and Mr. Martin's response was, but you saved Epona. And then he says, and you could stay here forever in paradise. Sam was guided to this island by the kind of sight of two children. In his grief-stricken state, I think the island called him to it.
I think that, and if you weave that in with Mrs. Martin having seen him on TV and the idea that she knew whatever tragedy struck with him, she might know, like, where, yeah. when, all those kind of things that would, yeah. like, place him where he was.
They knew why he was in the woods. They didn't really ask him a whole lot of questions. I mean, mm-mm. for as much as he talked about a day, he never really said, oh, yeah, I go to the woods every day, every March to, you know, commemorate the death of my small child. They knew why he was in the woods. Why Epona, this child, got off the island into the woods.
And it's far enough to fall asleep.
She was placed. Yeah, I think she was placed there. And she drinks the salt water, which is like a preservative.
I know. Well, not only that, but also I don't know a lot of live human people who drink salt water. And like, that's a good idea.
Caroline, I've got a whole fucking thing on salt. I don't know if you guys are ready. Again, I got a lot of stuff on salt. Salt is blowing my mind. But before we get there, because I think we're about to move on to OCD kind of permanently.
Oh, just I think it's a little early in the narrative. But I got a sense early on with Sam and OC that this was like Quaid going to meet Quado, you know, in terms of like everybody seems to know who he is.
Yeah.
Except for him. That, you know what I mean?
I saw no three-breasted hookers.
Nice. But no self-awareness. I think that part, that's what we spoke to. The idea of like, why are you just blathering off all of your personal information? Because he seems to have no self-awareness on the island.
But he's also drawn to the island, though. He mentions that he knows about it because of his grandfather was there during the war. But he also seems very drawn to the island as much as the island seems drawn to him.
He said it's familiar.
And why would it be? There's nothing like this island anywhere. Probably. I mean, he's in London. There's nothing like in London like OC. Why would it be familiar to him if he only knows about it tangentially through his grandfather, who probably is dead at this point if he was in World War II? True fact, the British Army did occupy the island during World War II.
A lot of the stuff that they like dumped in was like, that's real, and I know that to be real.
I think the show did some real nice like mythology, like checking, name dropping, mm-hmm. And also some real fact dropping too.
Well, let's move on to OC then.
Okay, well, but just before we go, why Florence and the Machine's Dog Days Are Over?
Good question, because I don't have an answer for you, but I do know it's important because it's the only pop music in the whole thing.
The song is interesting because the song is about the idea of happiness hitting you in the face in a way that the person that the song is about is uncomfortable by it. That joy comes upon them so suddenly as to scare them and to want to make them run from it. And run from the happiness, refusing to give up the life you've had to live the life you're meant to be. That's what the song is about. And so there's a lot there. I mean, there's a phrase in there about, you know, run fast for your mother, run fast for your fathers, run fast for your siblings, your sisters, and your brother. There's a lot of that. You refuse to better your lot. That you keep yourself stuck in the mud, as it were, instead of moving forward into a better life because you can't give up what you already kind of have. Think about Sam and as we kind of meet him and why he's listening to this song as he's kind of refusing to move on from his child's death, right? I mean, he has a conversation with Miss Martin about how grief is, you know, people don't think about the fact that you need grief. You need the pain to kind of either be alive or because it feels warm, Miss Martin says. It's comfortable. It's familiar. And that's kind of what Dog Days Are Over is about. Well-used song, I thought. I thought a good conversation piece, but definitely important, if nothing else, right? Like you said, Paul, because it's the only pop song used in the entire episode.
Just layering onto that, the idea that I know and have had conversations with parents who have gone through chronic illness or tragic times with a kiddo that may or may not have moved on from that. And there is a strange bedfellow with grief that is that familiarity that I know what it is in a way that can be almost addictive. People can almost want to go back to that time because there was something about it that, you know, maybe it wasn't quite over yet. It wasn't final, maybe, that his son was gone until a certain point. But if you could go back to the point where you were upset and grieving and maybe even unsure of where your kid was, if you go back to that, that's the time before you knew the outcome. And so there's a strange desire to kind of revisit a time, even when it is horrible grief.
I don't know if real people are as soulful as that, but we see that in TV and movies quite a bit. So there's got to be something to it. I mean, TV wouldn't lie.
So the addiction part that you were just talking about, the final lyrics of the song are, "And I never wanted anything from you except everything you had and what was left after that too, oh, happiness hit her like a bullet." So the idea that happiness is kind of like a drug, that you can run from it, but if it gets its hold in you, you won't be able to not move on from it. And so by kind of keeping yourself in the pain, you feel like you're maybe not betraying the memory of your kid. Maybe by moving on, you feel like you're betraying their memory.
100%. Yeah. Yeah. 100%. And it's, if you could freeze the moment forever where you didn't know for sure your child had died, you would, because you have to live the rest of your life knowing the child is gone.
Oh, well, before we get on the island, we see Mr. Cricket has not fared well. While alive on the tree in the woods, he is at the shoreline and he is dead with little spiders coming out of him. I don't know what the fuck that means, but it cannot be good.
I thought they're beetles. Caroline thought they were spiders. So there's two spiders to one beetle.
Well, I said cricket with spiders coming out.
Yeah, I thought there were like little spiders coming out of it too. Yeah,
I thought they were that kind of beetle that had like the twin prong horns off the front of their, I don't know, head. I don't know my insectary that well.
Beetles would be much more biblical than spiders, so I'm willing to go with beetles over that. But some disgusting little bug has now nested in the thousands inside this little Mr. Cricket. That can't be a good sign or an omen. And again, I think it's another sign of death in the husk of something living, right? Which is maybe what we're talking about, Pona.
Or I'm going to go a little Trojan horse action on you. You see the cricket, but underneath there's like all this shit crawling out of it.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like I'm saying death hiding in the body of living, right? The death of dead, like Pona maybe being dead or some kind of spirit in the husk or in the body of a living child.
I like that, but I think OC itself could be the cricket.
For sure. I think the metaphor spirals out a lot. Yeah.
Or if you just want to go seventh grade, it's a can of worms.
It's a total can of worms / spider mess. Yeah,
seventh grade is about as good as I get.
Spider beetles. It's a can of spider beetles.
It's a total spider pig situation.
That is worse.
So we're driving through the island, and Epona is kind of dropping. I think Paul's right. I think she's dropping all sorts of foreshadow warnings for us that we're too dumb at this point to understand or pick up on what they mean. In the water and the dirt, that's the lifeblood of this island. They have the Jesus in the Sea / Isis in the Sea festival is coming there, but they've made it a music festival. And then you have the weird little sea creature things with the scissors who come out of the water to snip out evil where they find it in small children and then, I guess, go back. I've never heard of that before. I've never ever heard of mythology or otherwise this creature, and I could not. I listened to it a couple times. I could not figure out what she was saying.
Oh, I couldn't make it out myself. I was gonna ask you a question that I'm sure has nothing to do with anything, but Caroline wanted to know.
What?
Those giant like pilgrim looking puppet things.
Oh, I was trying to figure out what they were from. I think they're actually called festival puppets because that I had looked up a lot about puppets. Okay. I may have or may not have visited a center for puppetry in my lifetime. And those particular kind of puppets, I believe in all my research, are actually called festival puppets.
I thought I recognized them from...
They're very pilgrimy.
Yeah, like New England-y sort of Thanksgiving celebrations.
But we're outside of London, so you can't go like an American point of view. It's got to be something else. But I think I remembered them more from like, this is going to be odd, but like South American festivals, like big parades where you have these sort of like big... They're like a
papier-mâché.
They're a hybrid of papier-mâché, like marionettes, plus stilt walkers.
Ah. Well, these just look like they were pushed around on trailers. I'm sure they are not important at all. I was just wondering if you had seen them in your neck of the woods or knew anything about those.
No, they reminded me of a pilgrim kind of thing, too. I'm up at the Encyclopedia of Puppetry right now, and apparently there is actually a whole French connection to these kind of giant puppets and street theater. They are religious also in certain parts of the world, in Tibet, in the Himalayas. The principal demons of Ramayana are represented, Ravana and his 10 heads, the symbol of destruction and the force of evil. It's a ritual. African giant puppets appear in certain countries. I don't know that they're important, but I notice them too, and they kind of creep me out.
So. Oh, I think that they definitely add that layer of freaky deaky that the show like continuously puts in place.
Especially the little scissor creatures. They
freaking scissor creatures.
They remind me of the spook things from the village, you know, that were there to scare people straight. And
I thought you were saying the spook creatures from Nightmare Before Christmas, the little Sandman spook things.
Nope. They also the village. Scare me. Just kind of the misshapen, not natural, monstrous type aspect.
Do you want to know one of the things I hate the most in a horror movie?
You dislike kind of unsteady start-stop walking.
Unnatural movements. Yes. It's not natural, I will shout out. That's not natural. And then I dislike it a lot.
Snipping at children.
Just their movements, the way that they move, the whole thing. Even the gigantic festival puppet idea, too. It's like that same thing. It's like, that's not the right proportions. It's not natural.
Kids are a little bit older, so I don't know if you guys missed the Phineas and Ferb.
Oh, we did not miss no Phineas and Ferb. We know all about the Ferbs.
Perry the platypus.
Perry the platypus. Yes.
Perry the platypus!
What's the sister's name?
Where did you get Candace? Mm-hmm. So the puppets, they look just like Ferb. You know, they have like a very similar kind of head shape to it, like Ferb does. But they also kind of look like the giant heads on like Easter Island also.
A little bit.
If you were to put the Easter Island heads on like big puppet bodies, like that's kind of what they would look like. I was more unnerved by when the costumed scissor evil eater took his head off and he like turned his head and he saw the car go by him. His face turned to malice immediately. Why does everyone hate Sam so much? He has saved this girl from hanging herself, and yet, basically, other than the Martins, everyone greets him with malice on this island.
That's what feeds this behind my brain idea that if we find out that he hit his head when he was 16 and has amnesia about his childhood, I'm not going to be surprised. That's why I think he's been there.
Okay, and I'm going to go with the idea that anytime you have a small, close-knit community and you have any person come on that may be an outsider, right, like a car you don't recognize or whatever, there's always that, like, everybody turns in the room and looks and stares, especially – I was going to say New England, but I know this is regular England, but there's that vibe, right? Mike, you know what I'm talking about. Like, go to Vermont and, like, see how many people stare at you.
Sure.
You don't belong here.
I think it's definitely some outsider. There's only 9 opponent tells Sam and us that there's only 93 people on the island.
And now there's 94. Things feel weird.
You can't believe, I mean, the island probably tilted, you know, with that probably kind of shift. Probably did. You can't tell what these people are capable of. You have no idea what these people are capable of, she says, which is a total double entendre.
Oh, God.
You know?
Hardcore.
Sam is familiar to this island. This island knows who Sam is, even if he's not quite aware of it yet. So I think we definitely have to bookmark to see how that kind of unfolds. You know, are they mad at him? Are they mad at him for being on the island, for being an outsider? Are they mad at him because he has Epona in his car?
That could be like a whole thing. Think about that.
Maybe she wasn't supposed to return. Maybe she was.
Oh, I'm going
sacrifice.
With just adult man with like, you know, 13-year-old girl.
Well, yeah. There's a lot of issues here. Right. Why are you showing up with my daughter? And Sam actually, out of the blue, kind of takes that defensive posture at one point. He says, I saved her. And then he's kind of like, yeah, but I wasn't like a total pedophile. I wasn't watching her hang herself through the woods. I just have, you know, like he was, I just saved her. That's all I did to her.
There
like,
was at least three or four moments when she actually wakes up and he jumps back and goes, I'm helping. Like there's that moment.
Yeah,
and then when they're in the car and he leans over to get the water and she jumps and he's like, I'm not like there was that moment. Like there was a lot of like hinting at worrisome behavior.
That is a cue that at least it's in our modern world where a grown man does need to have those.
You guys are grown men. Loud. You tell me. Is that how you do? You yell that? Like, I'm helping.
If I was helping a girl like that and there was like no other option, she's either going to die or I have to help her. Yeah, I think I would narrate quite a bit about what's going on.
Yeah.
I'm helping. I'm a good person.
Right. Well, yeah, we're going to film this just in case it becomes important later for details.
God.
Right.
That's funny.
Right. Though I tell you, him smushing his face up against her little teenage bosom, not a good look on you. Buddy,
oh, God.
Not a good look on you. It made me very uncomfortable. I did not like it.
They went out of their way to give her a wardrobe that was younger than even she was. Like she had like a little bare face smile. smile on her shirt, yes, and stuff. That was really like a toddler shirt.
Which, spoilers, oddly fits Jude Law very well later on in the episode, which is disturbing. But let's get to the Oyster Pub and let's meet the Martins, because these are some weird fucking people. Holy shit. What did you guys think of Mr. and Mrs. Martin?
Something immediately seems off with this pair.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, she only refers to him in disparagingly, fuckhead, and things like that. He just sheds it off like no big deal. Bark is way worse than her bite.
She's a funny fish, Paul.
Funny fish, right. All that. No big deal. Just smiles through the whole thing like he's got a lobotomy.
Definitely shit-eating grin is what I apply to him very much.
Yeah, right.
Like in a suspicious, shifty kind of way. He looks like the guy who greets you at the start of every horror novel that you read. You know, like, you'll definitely be safe in room one. There's no false door there. Sure, your liver won't be missing in the morning. No, you'll be perfectly safe. You won't wake up in a nice bath. No. Okay. Yeah, that's that guy, for sure.
He had an interesting mannerism that I kept trying to rack my brain for who else that I know in pop culture that had these same mannerisms. And the only person I could come up with is George McFly, in terms of, like, his whole continuously tucking his shirt back into his pants. That is such this, like, nerd anxiousness cue that I get that is deeply embedded in me because of Back to the Future.
Smooth down your hair.
Continuously smooth down your hair, tuck in and adjust your belt and pants, and be kind of doing that really big grin and that like, kind of laugh. That's all
just 24/7 social awkward
nerd anxiousness. Yeah.
It almost played sinister to me in how socially awkward it was. I was in marching band. I know socially awkward pretty well. And he's some next level shit.
Have you met Paul?
What? What are you talking about?
You're also in band. You also know the nerd factor.
That's true. So I would characterize maybe that behavior possibly as nervous. Do you think? Like a tick?
Like hiding something?
Sorry. It's like an attempt to look all put together. Think about it very literally. You're smoothing down your hair and you're tucking your shirt in to look a certain way, to come off put together. But if you take that from like a psychological or like a more emotional standpoint, it's like he is trying to put on a certain face, a certain look, and he wants you to only see that look. And sometimes, like his wife would just fucking crack that in half and just be like, fuck face. And then that isn't putting on the look of like a loving couple with this bar and blah, blah, blah. You know, like she'll just like bust it in half. And then that's when he gets real anxious and he starts adjusting himself.
Hmm.
It's a certain look. It's a very Facebook status moment where it's like, I got to look a certain way. I definitely think super sinister. The moment that I made my decision about Mr. Martin was when Sam was talking about Ade outside. Mr. Martin's like, you know that he stole from you. You need to confront him. Like, just like instantly started manipulating him like that.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, you're a bad dude. Because 90% of people would say,
this is not my business.
Sounds like a bad situation. Right. You know, they wouldn't say shit.
Well, that was the first thing that struck me, was like, so how nosy was, and not only nosy, but like nosy and then manipulative about it, because he knows Sam is going to listen to him. How he knows that, we don't know yet. Well, the whole story of the island, that it's a dry island for sober people, but he keeps feeding Sam free beer, you know, like
in a pub.
It's all contradiction. And then laughs like it never occurred to him how funny that is. You know, he's got those Memento Mori pictures on their wall, like the death mask like photos. Like, that's some weird shit. I've been in a lot of bars. I've never seen Memento Mori photos hanging on the wall. That's creepy.
I think I've seen that maybe in places that were going for that vibe, like Ripley's Believe It or Not, or remember in Austin, what was it, Caroline, the Museum of the Weird?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I believe they might have had some decor.
I'm sure of
similar.
Yeah, absolutely, like gross, gross, yes, faces, without a doubt.
Yeah, so at the end of the day, though, so they take Ipana, like they acknowledge like she's really there. Corporeally, I don't think we're dealing with like a ghost. I think we're dealing with someone who's like physically there.
But
they're also not as nearly freaked out by the, again, like the choke, the ligature marks from a rope, you know, burned into her neck, as they should be.
When you think about though, Aponia, like if you keep like moving her through the whole timeline, think about when Mr. Martin's like, oh, we should bring her out to Sam and like show her off to him that she's okay. Mrs. Martin's like, you need to grow a pair. And like, also kind of like, what the fuck are you thinking? In that whole, like, we have like a decaying corpse and you're a fool to say we should march her out here. You know, like there's that feel of like, we can't show you an intact human right now and you're an ass for saying it.
That was my exact same take too when I reflected on why she would say that to him, that obviously we cannot show Epona to this guy. You know, he's already super fucking suspicious, especially after Crazy Dad shows up with his rifle, screaming and shouting about it. Yeah, I had the same take also, that there is no Epona to show. And I think I got a little bit of that feeling too when he's in the rear view and he decides to go try and make it to the causeway and he sees her leaving in the rear view mirror, or imagines her leaving and then imagines himself running after her. I don't think any of that was real. I think that was all his mind, or some kind of prophecy in his mind, or his subconscious telling him something is wrong with Epona, but then he squashes it to try and get off the island.
I thought that was just like his imagination. I believe that Epona was in the rear view, but then I think he was just thought of himself going after her again, but then thought, no, I got to get back to my life. And that's when he speeds off in vain toward the causeway.
The 3:52 deadline.
Right.
I see. And I think it was just emotional guilt. I mean, the idea that he had that, you guys never have that thing where you have that, like, that icky feeling that you feel like something's wrong and you think like, I should turn back around. I should go back and just check that one more time. And I even daydream it. Like, did I unplug that appliance? Is the garage door down? Like those kind of moments. But if you have this much bigger moment where you've just left a child who may or may not been committing suicide with people who you are very suspect of, how do you leave with a calm heart? How are you not daydreaming the idea of saving her?
I just looked up something that I think might be interesting. In that scene when Epona is in the side room with the Martins and that door is ominously flapping open and closed, that is one of those scenes that has been color graded severely. And there is a really pale wash over most of the room. But that room that they're in, whenever the door opens, it's bright green. It's just like a very pervasive, everything's green in there sort of thing. Mm-hmm. In the UK, the color green is considered unlucky. And that superstitions go back as far as the 1700s, which, you know, is kind of a long time. That to wear green is to bring about death.
Interesting.
Meow, meow, meow. How do you like that?
Thank you, Sherlock Catface. Yes.
I feel like more salt has just gathered at my feet. Oh. Interesting. Yeah, there's a lot of death symbolism, though, I think, in the show.
Well, and can I say that flapping door thing? I think that that was so striking because there was also that sort of that feeling of like, it's a little Schrodinger's cat. And every time it flaps open, didn't you kind of think she might not be there, or they yes. might not be there, or yes. something? It was like every time it flapped open, it was like, it felt like, I don't know what I'm going to see on the other side. Something fucked up is going to be on the other side. But it never was. It was the same people standing there. And it was like, how is this not more weird?
Them being there was actually more weird than had they just disappeared.
Yeah, or just walked away. Like, why are you still standing right there?
And, like, kind of staring out at me as if, like, like, well, maybe, but maybe not, though. Maybe they're trying to confirm, like, did this guy touch you? Like, what the fuck? Like, you're showing up, like...
That's how it felt in that moment, for sure, if did someone touch you. Like, let me just usher you to the side quickly and ask you some questions.
Well, let me ask you, is that why Jason, her angry, angry dad, shows up so hot? Does he show up because some man has brought his daughter home? That seems an interesting take, when maybe you should be more concerned, one, that your daughter was off the island in the woods. Two, your daughter was off the island in the woods hanging herself. And three, this guy brought her home alive-ish, maybe.
It doesn't seem like the time to bring out the shotgun.
Yeah, his anger seemed very pointed towards Sam, to the point, and Sam knew that. I don't know how Sam knew that. There wasn't a lot of dialogue that would indicate that, not until they make eye contact in the window. But Sam is terrified of this father. He's hiding in the salt-floored bathroom, trying very hard not to be seen. Why?
Well, let's play that out just a little bit more. Okay, so think about this. Your daughter is brought home. Here's through word of mouth, because we've got the sea creature snipping, staring into the car, all that stuff. Word of mouth quickly gets to Dad that a man just drove your daughter up but dropped her off at the Martins. A series of questions as dad, right? What the fuck is she doing at the Martin's house? Why didn't she come home? What is going on? Who has her? Who took her? What are you guys doing? I mean, I would have a lot of reasons to have my gun.
Well, maybe, but I'm picking up Epona's vibe that she's terrified of her father. She wants to go to the Martins because she does not want her father to know either what happened with the hanging or just know that she's home. There's a real fear of dad. And I gotta tell you, I got a total sexual molestation feel between Epona and the father. And I would not be surprised if it turns out that Epona is pregnant with her father's baby.
Whoa.
That's how we do on OC.
That's outrageous. See, but I'm going to go back to the what we know about different characters. We really don't know shit about dad, whereas we're all uneasy with the Martins. We all think they're weirdos and not the people that you would necessarily run to.
Oh, I think dad's a weirdo too. I mean,
okay, but given that, but we don't know that at this point, right? We don't know. We don't know he's a weirdo, but we definitely know that the Martins were uneasy with. So why not give him the benefit of the doubt that he is a normal person and saying, why are you hanging out with the weirdos? Get home.
Well, he day drinks on the beach.
He day drinks on the beach and he talks about the cunt in the big
day
house.
Day drinks.
Because I believe children before I believe adults always. If a kid is telling me I'm scared of my father and what he's going to do with me, which I think she basically says in the car, that's enough for me to be wary of the father more than the Martins, at least as a starting position. And Ms. Martin seems very concerned about Epona. I mean, Mr. Martin is like, oh, I haven't had a bit of a game, love. Oh, I just fucking around in the woods, love. And you know, she's like, ah, you shit for brains. Yeah, shut the fuck up. But she seems genuinely concerned about Epona, you know, and the father gives us no reason not to think he's not a hothead. We see him with show up the gun screaming his head off. And the next time we see him, after he's done crying with the white-haired man in the white-haired suit, who I'm pretty sure is Colonel Sanders, he's pissing and drinking on the beach, talking about cunts in the big house. So Jason is not making a great first impression, maybe even worse than the Martins to me.
He's probably worth keeping an eye on in terms of parallels with Sam, because this episode is called The Father, and we know that Sam has two daughters and a son.
Right.
And we know that, but Jason's the only father for sure that we've been introduced to. So
Right. Maybe
that's just a reason to put a little dog ear on your Jason page.
Yeah, no, and we don't know if there are any other siblings. We don't know if there's, I don't know that we know if there's a wife around. And then the only other person we find out that has kids is Jess, who has a do-nothing husband, but also has two daughters, no son. A lot of specific information given about children here. I want to talk about the scene in the bathroom, though, with the salt, but I also want to talk about the guy in the white-haired suit, the Colonel Sanders, that shows up out of nowhere and gets him to weeping, gets Jason not only to calm down, but to, like, break down in tears through the window. Who the fuck is that guy? Is he the one who lives in the big house? Who do we think he is? Is he the mayor of the island?
He's Ricardo Montalban.
Is he Charrington? Is he the guy who bought the island forever ago? Is he like the undead spirit of the island?
The
owner?
Undead spirit?
Yeah.
We don't have much to go on. We have the history of the island. We don't really know anything about how this island is governed. And as Americans, we'd have even less idea than
right.
Local.
The island in real life is owned by a music producer named Nigel Frieda. So the same way that Charrington bought OC was a brewery guy, Charrington, you know, ale, and bought the island to create a sober paradise, the way Martin tells it, is the real thing in real life. Its entire island is owned by one guy who then rents it out and kind of is like a big island landlord. Charrington, or at least the Charrington family, probably is the big house, is probably still the owner of the island, I would imagine.
Well, if that all links together, then, you know, Colonel Sanders is probably Mr. Big House.
Mr. Big House and some descendant of Charrington, if not Charrington himself. But again, ethereal, how he just appears out of nowhere. He's not there when Jason's just walking up with his rifle, shouting and yelling, and the Martins are outside. And then he is there, and he's got his hand up all Jesus-like, and Jason just starts to weep. We can't hear what's going on, but it backs him down, like, immediately, until he gets up to day drinking later on when we see him on the beach. But yeah, I want to know who that guy is. He was a big question mark in my notes.
That's all we got for him this week, though. I mean, he doesn't show up again in the episode.
So the other part of the bathroom scene, what is the deal with the salt and the sink. I thought, you know, at first I thought it was white sand. But then as the episode went on and then I watched it a second time, I was like, no, I think that might be salt because salt is such like a big thing here. Why is there salt on the floor at all in like a very kind of sculpted way? And then later on, not too much later on, like less than an hour on, there's like twice as much salt on the floor. And again, well-groomed, well like raked sand in like a concentric circle kind of thing. Any ideas on that?
Man, I wish I knew. I know that it has something to do with Epona's saying that everything about their culture is tied to either soil or salt. So it makes me wonder if there's sort of, if those are like a yin and a yang for them, a balance has to be struck. I don't know what that has to do with salt on your bathroom floor. When I see salt on the floor in any situation from other movies, I instantly start thinking of pagan stuff, you know, like circles and stuff that are meant for protection and that kind of stuff. This wasn't really that, but it wasn't really not that either.
Well, I think I tie into that. And for me, while you guys are focused on the fact that it's in a bathroom, I was focused on the fact that it was where you would stand looking in the mirror. And that was very Bloody Mary, Bloody Mary, Bloody Mary to me. If you were making some sort of circles and you were, I don't know, conjuring some shit, you might stand in the middle of the circle, look in the mirror, turn out the lights, and pull a full Bloody Mary sitch. So for me, I was focused on the mirror and the whole setup, not so much that we were in the bathroom.
I thought it might have something to do with water, though.
I like the water from the sink and the
and how she put salt in the water that she drank and
no for sure I well Mike's got a lot on salt, so I'm excited to hear.
Well, let's go back to the paganism, because salt and the circle of protection to keep out the devil forces is a really interesting thought, because there's a lot of lore about looking in a mirror is mirrors are windows to the soul, whatever you are through the mirror. And so there's an interesting idea there that by standing within the salt circle on the floor and you're looking in the mirror, you're maybe giving yourself some protection.
Or I'm saying pull somebody out. That's what Bloody Mary's about. Bloody Mary shows you a different person in the mirror.
I would definitely think after the Bacchanal, when he goes, when he's all happy and then he goes in the mirror and, yeah, you know, he goes from smiley face and we get the real close up on his face and his pores. And then he kind of turns, he kind of goes, you know, Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. And then, mm-hmm, and that sets off of the fucking trippiest scene of television I've maybe ever seen. It's only 4 minutes, but it seems like forever. And it's so weird. Right before the Bacchanal starts, we meet Larry, the neck tattoo guy, who's one of Jason's buddies from the beach, who is, again, very antagonistic towards Sam, who, as far as we know, these two have never met. And he walks in, and he's like, ah, say yada guy. Any guy with a neck tattoo, with like three guns on his neck or knives on his neck, something like that. I'm going to be wary of that guy anyway. Him and the Martins, I remember him as a little boy. But then they go downstairs, right? Mr. Martin and Larry see each other downstairs, and they make the reverse cross, which is a very satanic, scented, paganistic cult kind of thing. To making a reverse sign of the cross where you go from the bottom up and then you go right, left. I had to do it to myself just now.
I did it myself as well.
That's like very satanic, tainted kind of magic there. So it really kind of plays into the whole salt and protection thing. Is salt really kind of an armor here that Sam would do well to keep around him with these forces that may or may not be on the island? That's not a thing that, like, I don't know any guys who, like, kind of stare at each other in, like, the basement of a building and go, yo, bro, let's make some signs of the reverse signs of the crosses.
Do you guys think it's odd when you were talking about that Larry thing and you were talking about the idea of, like, when Mr. Martin says we remember him as a boy? That is such a thing to say if you are much older than the person you're talking about. If you are 20 plus years older, you might refer to that other person as a boy. But here's the thing. Larry and Mr. Martin don't seem to be that much different in age. Yes, Mr. Martin's older. Don't get me wrong. It's almost more like they would have been peers, and you might have said, like, I remember us when we were children, but not I remember him as a boy. I don't know. That felt weird to me. Like that sort of undead, the Martins could be 1,000 years old, you know?
Well, Jason to have a daughter Epona's age is probably a little bit younger than the Martins, but not terribly so. And if Larry's hanging out with Jason, you would imagine they are somewhat contemporaries.
Something's off.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. It was a weird line. Just the way, and just the idea of we still remember him as a boy. That's something you say about like someone maybe who's in prison or who has died, not someone who was just in the room. That's a really weird way to phrase thinking about someone unless you have literally frozen something in time.
Or complete changes in personality.
Before he got to the drink, or before he got to the drugs, or before this, we remember him as a sweet boy. Not just generally, well, we still remember him as a young boy. And then he blames the death of the oyster beds when they're on the beach and they're oyster fishing. We see there's only one oyster in the bucket. So maybe the oyster beds are not doing great here on OC. But, I mean, Billy Joel has Downeaster Alexa, and that's his, like, rage song about the death of fishing off of islands. It just seemed like a very weird phrasing for Mr. Martin to use for Larry. And then when you combine it with the whole satanic thing down in the basement, there's some needful things or some Rosemary Baby shit going on here. The cross thing, the reverse cross thing, gave me like a real Rosemary's Baby kind of vibe to it.
And that there's something else afoot. I mean, obviously there's the Satanism stuff, but that there is some direction, or there is some forethought to what they're doing, where what they're doing upstairs is some amount of play acting compared to what they, you know, what they're actually doing.
Yeah, they're putting on a show for Sam's benefit or for the Bacchanal, because once the Bacchanal gets going and everyone's drinking, Larry's there with his accordion. He's singing, he's, you know, accompanying the piano player saying swim swim Sam swim. That's Larry playing the accordion, you know?
Yeah,
so the whole
yeah.
thing is real fucking weird. So there's a fuck ton of salt in the Bible. It comes up constantly in the New Testament and in the Old Testament. There's a passage in 2 Kings chapter 2, verse 21 says, "Then he went to the spring of water and threw salt in it and said, 'Thus says the Lord, I have healed this water. From now on, neither death nor miscarriage shall come from it.'" And I thought that was really interesting that salt cured the water. The larger passage is the prophet Elisha has come to town, and the people are like, this water is bad in this river. And so he throws salt in the river, and he says, the river's clean now. No more death or miscarriage will come from it. And I thought it was really interesting in the fact of the Martins and their seven miscarriages. The idea of salt and the miscarriage, and again, more fertility and birth and death. It all was kind of like weird. Like, is the salt like a protection on this island, or is it a weapon? Is it a good thing or a bad thing here?
It seems like a healing type thing, like you said, a protection.
That's how it's most often used in the Bible. A couple other uses of the Bible: offerings and sacrifices always have to be accompanied by salt. If you don't accompany by salt, it is a bad offering. It is offensive to the God. It is offensive to God, especially in the Old Testament. They're big on offerings and sacrifices in the Old Testament. Also, salt is referred to in the Bible as being a sign of friendship. If you're Game of Thrones fans, you know, anyone who's read Game of Thrones or any kind of medieval thing, you talk about, like, you know, I've had salt, I've eaten salt under in your home. That confers upon you the right of the guest right, that no harm shall befall you. That's why the Red Wedding is so shocking in Game of Thrones, because they have the meat and mead, they eat of the salt, and then they get killed under the house. Spoilers. And so, yeah, and so the idea that you share salt as a sign of friendship. So when she put salt in her water, it was like an interesting symbolic thing to me that she was doing it. Was she doing it as like they use the word covenant a lot in the Bible, but it's like a covenant of friendship. It's a covenant of trust, but it's a sign of like respect and a way of going about, of signifying that you are safe here and or I acknowledge you as a friend or trusted person.
Well, that's interesting, because if you noticed, like in the pub later in the evening, when it's just Sam and Jess in the pub, there is a serving tray that is heaped over with salt.
Two big bowls of heaping salt, yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, which where your peanuts would be, but no peanuts.
And I mean, I didn't see anybody offer Sam any salt, to your point about friendship and all that stuff. But the idea that culturally that they would have these sort of rites and things that all revolve around salt in some way, that seems to make more sense, like you're saying.
As happy as Mr. Martin seems, the play he's putting on the first floor about giving him room one, about you stay here in paradise forever, but he never offers him salt. He offers him beer, he plies him with beer, but he never offers him any of those big bowlfuls of salt. But yet in the bathroom, around the mirror, around the sink, there is salt for him to stand upon and maybe be protected. So there may be forces here that are working you know, maybe fighting over Sam.
But it was
on the island.
It was the wife that said, you can use the nice bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. And the wife not seen throwing gang signs down in the basement.
Right. So, right. There you go.
Yeah. So interesting. So I think we have to keep an eye out for Salt. Let's get really quickly to the boy as a guide on the island. He leads into that abandoned structure. What did you guys take of the symbolism of the dead rats, the dead rabbits, the bear suit, and then Sam seeing himself covered in blood, wearing Epona's shirt, kind of sitting cross-legged on the floor screaming?
That stuff continued to feed my sense that he has been there before, that he has seen fucked up shit happen there. He was remembering something more than he was experiencing it right then.
Oh, I like that. I like that.
But in terms of symbolism, maybe Caroline's got something a little deeper than that.
Oh, you know, I watched that scene through my fingers, so I was pretty freaked out by the whole thing. I mean, the only thing I could figure was the sacrifice feel of having the dead animals and you're walking, it's like, and then it becomes bigger and bigger, and then it's like a human hand, and it seems like it was escalating. It felt like mm-hmm. It was an escalating situation.
This is right on earlier, he sees the ritualistically dissected rabbit in the field.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Before then, you back up more, you see the husk, right? The cricket husk with the spider beetles inside of it.
Felt,
you know,
escalating. Surrounded is the by word death, I'm using.
That's for sure.
There was an escalation. Yeah, I don't know if he was remembering or if he was having a sense of dread. You know, he was having more of a metaphorical experience about what the island is. I think that boy is his son, is a representation of his dead son. I think the boy is a safe guide for him, showing him dangers of the island. Like maybe Mrs. Martin, like we're hypothesizing maybe, is the salt, is his salt protection versus the forces on the island that may not be so pro-Sam.
Caroline had a good observation, our viewing, and
if only she was alive.
If only she could remember these things in the moment. It was just that it reminded us of Lost quite a bit. Just the whispering.
Why didn't you just prompt me?
On the island, and the idea of dead people showing up to show you one thing. At least I'm not talking about the stuff that they explained as the reason for that. I'm talking about the initial feelings of just the spookiness when Lost was still kind of, you know, mystical.
And being sort of like lured, like having, like hearing something just out of your, just out of your reach, you either hear or see something and it makes you go and investigate it further and further. And you suddenly you're down the rabbit hole, you know. You got way further than you ever would have.
Doesn't explain the bear shirt with Jude Law in it. But
that's the shirt that Epona's wearing, though.
Yeah.
I mean, so they're connected. Epona stands for something in Sam's life, either as stand-in for his own child's loss or something that he experienced on the island that he doesn't remember. Her being in the woods is not a coincidence. None of it feels coincidental. It all feels plotted. It all feels planned. It all feels he's being lured here at a time when the island knows he is weak spiritually and emotionally and intellectually weak because of the grief period that he's going through. And Epona plays some unknown role in that at this point, I think.
But by putting him in the shirt and making him all bloody and all that, are you suggesting that there's a certain sameness or, like you said, connection between what he's going to go through and what she's going through?
Or has been through. Right. That he may be a sacrifice for the island in the same way maybe she was a sacrifice for the island. He's been called here for some reason. And I was reflecting throughout the episode because it comes up a lot. There's a lot of things that get repeated, which you guys have mentioned a bunch of them. But the fact that the island needs this festival, the Isis festival, has been opened up because they need it. And the immediate sense is the island needs it for money. But by the end of the episode, I was convinced that the island needs it for people. The miscarriages of the Martins, other than Epona, we don't see any other small children running around on this island, any young people other than maybe Ghost Boy, who we don't know is really there yet.
Well, we saw some kids getting teased by the monsters with the scissors.
That's true.
It wasn't overrun with children. I'll give you that.
But they also may have been tourists, though, right? Because that's the kind of thing that people in a festival would do to the tourist kids, right?
Well, and need to take the mask off and show the kid it's just me. If you live there your whole life, why would you need to take your mask off and show the kid that it's you if they do this every year?
You've been to Salem. Is there that kind of wiggity shit that happens?
I have been to Salem. I mean, it wasn't going on while I was there, but it's definitely the type of place that wiggity shit could go on for sure. I mean, no one was walking around snipping at people. No.
Those are big scissors.
Well, there's a lot of mythology and lore out there about places that have, I mean, the island in Lost, right? The others, their whole thing was they were stealing babies because they had a maternity problem, right? They could not have childbirth on the island.
Spoilers.
I think OC is, oh, come on. I think Pod Clubhouse just ran a poll about J.J. Abrams' greatest shows and Lost one handily. So I think enough people are clued in on Lost. But I was left with the idea that the island needs people, not for money, but it needs it for bodies. It needs it for reproduction. I think it's a dying island.
The island
I think it
is
needs
a wraith.
Something, but I'm not going to go with bodies. I think it needs something. Maybe energy, maybe souls.
The seven
maybe
miscarriages
whatever.
It was such a specific thing to bring up.
So you're saying that they're bringing them there to snatch their children, or they're bringing them there to impregnate and give birth?
Both. Impregnate would be ideal, but to snatch children and raise them as the island's own otherwise, but more just to bring in fresh DNA. The idea of the reason why we needed the people on the 847 people and their babies is because the idea that maybe their body parts will work correctly and we'll be able to have kids, that for whatever reason, whatever's happening on this island has made some sterility, which makes Epona even more important than to the island, which you would then think maybe her hanging herself becomes even more heightened because as one of the few young people that she would try to hang herself. Why? That's a drastic thing for a kid to do. What has happened in her life to make her do that? Which we didn't really touch upon at all, but if this was a real child really hanging herself, that's a significant thing for her to do. That's a drastic step for her to do. It's not easy to hang yourself, especially if you're going to do it in the woods. There's a lot of things you have to do to do that correctly.
Yeah, you need a ghost boy to tie off your rope.
Yeah.
You have to get yourself to the woods far off the causeway.
Right. But you have to know when the causeway is going to be there and not be there. Right. A lot of older couples don't have kids. But to bring it up, and not just we had one lost, and I'm assuming miscarriage. They don't actually say miscarriage. They say, they phrase it differently.
But not one came to term.
That's a very specific and very high number to put out there for it to not mean anything.
Think that there's infertility issues on the island. I definitely think that there's problems. Again, though, go back to any small-knit community. You would find the same things. You would find, like, we're running out of people to get married to one another who aren't already related. You know, you'd get down to the infertility in a place where they seem to be eating up the salt. I mean, boy, you might be fucking with your bodies, people.
Right. Well, and remember, Epona, a Celtic goddess, one of the things she was known for was fertility. Yeah, I think there's a whole lot of stuff in symbolism.
I'm fully with it. I wasn't sure where you were going with it, if about stealing people from the festival or exactly. I agree with you that
I think it's like a dying population kind of sitch, and they need body for something. I think Sam has been lured to the island. That was my definite takeaway. Because also then you have Jess, who we didn't talk about at all. You have Jess kind of comes in the fifth act of the episode. She's kind of a mainlander. But she loves this island. She's been there a bunch. She's a PhD in witch trials, Essex witch trials. She loves the fucking and the drinking. She's all about it. I think you got to imagine that her and Sam are going to go once they're sharing a bed, at the end of this episode or the next episode.
Well, they do both seem good and pissed, as they say locally.
Indeed. Mm-hmm. And homie's rolling 40 deep, you know? I mean, he's got stacks that he could, like, toss on the bed, you know, like a baller. So, yeah, he's got pounds to spare.
You know, there's a lot of women on TV that are not well-written, and there was something about Jess, I don't know if it was the actress herself or if it was that well written, but I really liked her as a character. I really felt like she had these moments that were so believable, and I really liked looking at her face. And she wasn't somebody who is like over the top gorgeous or like, you know, just drop your jaw, but she was somebody who seemed like you would absolutely want to have a beer with, and she would be funny and she would go along with it. Like, she would be someone I would go on an adventure with. So I really liked her as my potential love interest, but at least, you know, a friend, because it could have been anybody, but like somebody else to go adventuring with that was not a local.
She's one of the guys with boobs, right? And for a lot of guys, that's like the ideal woman for a lot of dudes. And she had like a real vibe, like a real easygoing vibe, kind of like a sass mouth, kind of like, you know, like really give shit kind of thing. Definitely someone who could hang with your friends and curse and watch rugby or soccer or football or whatever the fuck.
Just a regular hooligan.
A fun Jude Law fact. There's a connection there. Mr. Talented Mr. Ripley. Catherine Waterston plays Tina Goldstein in the Fantastic Beasts movie, in which Jude Law appeared in the second one as Albus Dumbledore. So there is your Harry Potter Fantastic Beasts connection. The two of them appeared in The Crimes of Grindelwald together. So there you go.
Whoa.
So, yeah, but I liked their chemistry. I liked her a lot. She felt very lived in.
Well, just natural. I don't know if this is a casting choice that made this work so well, or if they wrote this character so well. Is it Catherine, or is it just this was a well-written part?
I mean, I think it's both. I might lean more toward the actress, actually, not in terms of the ability to make the lines sing a little bit more with her, what she's doing with her face and that
stuff.
Yeah,
she acted the shit out of it with her face, right?
No matter how well the words are written, you need an actor to convey them well. And I think she conveys them very, very well and believably.
I liked her a lot. There are very few people who I really feel like, you know, I would follow their work and like, continue to watch just because they were in it. And she's actually somebody now that I didn't have on my radar at all.
I'm very interested to see what their story becomes, right? Because she's billed as the other lead in the series with Jude Law in these first three episodes. I don't think she's just going to be like a bar denizen who is like an observer of the island's behavior, like an outsider. And she doesn't really feel like an outsider. She felt like an outsider who was very accepted on the island, whereas Sam felt like an outsider who was not accepted. So it was a very like weird kind of diametrically opposed reception for the two of them. What's a big question for you guys that you'd like to answered or more find out more about in the next couple episodes while we have the summer section going on? What's like your number one question?
Number one question is, what is Sam's connection to this island?
I think that's a good one, and I would be very disappointed if we don't find that out. I feel like that is a big old Damocles sword hanging above his head that we have to find the answer to, or else why are we even doing this exercise? So I agree with you.
Well, definitely, absolutely. That I mean, he is the driving force for this entire three-part series. I really enjoy the Just Sam interactions, and the more of that action I can get, the more I think I will be continuously drawn in and can kind of smooth over the scary parts for me. I have a hard time when people act oddly, and I really feel like since the entire town acts oddly, I'm like a bundle of nerves watching it. How about you, Mike? What questions do you want answered?
I'm really into the religious allegory stuff that this show is raising. I mean, we haven't even talked about the fact the third day is an obvious Bible reference to Jesus and his resurrection. There's a bunch of versions of it. But if you look at 1 Corinthians 15:4, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the scriptures. And there's variations of that throughout the New Testament. Crucified on a Friday and put in the cave. The stone was, you know, rolled in front of it. And then on the third day, he rose.
Hey, hold on a second. Pause. Hit the button. Ready? Mm-hmm. Sacrificed on Friday and the stone was in front of him. And then go back to that scene of him inside that like kind of stone building.
Yeah.
Apparently sacrificed in some way on Friday.
Yeah. And the name of this episode was Friday, the Father. There's a lot going on here. So the first three episodes are Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And the subtitles are Friday, the Father, Saturday, the Son, Sunday, the Ghost, which is the other big Bible reference that we haven't remarked on is the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, which is a reference to the Christian Trinity. The idea that God is three separate aspects. It is the Father, the Son, who is Jesus Christ, and then the Holy Spirit, which imbues, you know, everyone and everything. That God is all three of those things all at once. There's an obvious Jesus Christian versus Celtic mythology battle going on here. And I wonder if that's not what the island struggle is. If it's not the Celtic mythology, the Jesus of it all versus the Jesus. That's what the subtitle is. It's Isis versus Jesus, right? Isis being this warrior, woodsman, Celtic mythic figure. Like I heard when Epona says it, Jesus and the sea, which is how Sam hears it. Sam hears it as Jesus and the sea, which is a very peaceful kind of thing. The idea, I mean, Jesus, several of his apostles were fishermen. Jesus and the water are very, and fishermen are very much connected in the Bible. So it's a very, there's a very mythology versus Bible kind of battle here.
So you're hoping for some sort of death match between deities.
Right. A monotheology versus polytheology.
That's no big deal. I'm sure they did that on Friends.
They did. The one about all the gods. So, you know, there's the Hanukkah. There's when he dresses up as the Hanukkah porcupine, right?
The Maccabees, right?
Yes.
Armadillo.
Yeah. Armadillo, that's what it was. God damn it. I'm the holiday armadillo. When I heard the third day, that was the first thing I thought of. And then when I read about it, I was like, oh, that's definitely going to be a thing. So
I'm very much wondering, given the causeway and given the water and everything, and we have referenced Lost already, if the island itself has its own
agenda.
Yeah. Because there's the people but then there's like, and you know, we cover Yellowstone as well over on Pod Clubhouse. And there's a lot of talk about like the land having a soul, a land having its being its own character. This is a special place. They consistently reference it as like paradise and a special place. And the way the causeway kind of comes and goes, there's this feel of like it has its own soul, you know.
Those overhead shots of the causeway almost feel like a slow motion tentacle, like reaching
or
out.
Like, yeah. Oh, I like that. I was gonna say like an artery, but yeah, I like that. That some sort of like yeah, like a reaching. Yeah.
Well, okay. We also cover Lovecraft Country here on Pod Clubhouse, so we're into tentacles.
So we are into tentacles. Yes.
Getting our Cthulhu up in here.
Cthulhu.
I think the island definitely is a character in the show. I think it's unclear whether it's a malicious character or a peaceful character as far as Sam goes. And I'm also curious if the boy in the red shorts boy is a avatar for the island.
Oh, boy. Look at that. That all just really runs together pretty well.
I think he's a manifestation of the sun, but I'm curious if he is an island's avatar for luring Sam or tempting Sam or making Sam pay. It's unclear if Sam is due a reward from the island or if he's due a retribution from the island.
I think part of that comes from the idea that we don't know what role he may have played in his son's death. There's some uncertainty about whether he was, you know, could be considered responsible, or was this a situation where he was, you know, had nothing to do with it? I don't know. But again, that idea of like whether or not you'd have consequences or not, what role did you play in the death of a child? Seems like the island could get pissed, you know?
Yeah. And the death of his own child.
What if he had to save a child then? And then you're like kind of neutral and you can come back.
Well, right. Well, did he pass a test then by saving, quote unquote, saving Epona? Mm-hmm. But then why is he wearing her shirt in his sacrifice scene in the cave? Is Sam a sacrifice for all of us? Is he a Jesus character? Is he been sacrificed on this Friday and we'll see him rise again in Sunday to his glory, to his paradise? I don't know. I don't know, but there's a lot of question marks here. Where
how does he fit in Garanimals?
Yeah, that was a tiny shirt. But going back to my comment on the How Did He Untie Her, they're basically the same size. Spot on, y'all. He does fit in that shirt.
I mean, I'd be hesitant to see if he can't fit into the little boy's red shorts or his boots.
Yay,
I mean,
yay.
Well, we don't need that on camera. We can just get an after action on that.
I'm super looking forward to continuing this mystery because this is exciting to me. And there's just enough scariness to, you know, keep me on my toes, but not enough to keep me awake at night. So here's hoping episode 2 brings lots of answers, guys.
That is nailing a sweet spot in the Caroline horror genre. That's like
titillating, but not upsetting.
That's like hitting the green surrounded by a water trap. Just nailing it. So that says a lot about what this show's accomplishing.
I'm mostly scared all the time.
That's so funny.
God.
Well, I hope you guys join us for the next episode, The Stun, airing next week, and we'll be back to talk about it.
Thanks so much for listening. This is Caroline.
This is Paul.
And this is Mike.
Thank you for listening. This has been an original Pod Clubhouse production. Pod Clubhouse is a podcast network dedicated to encouraging collaboration among podcasters and friends to bring a fresh voice and diverse perspective on a wide array of content. Please visit and leave a comment for us at podclubhouse.com. Rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast feeds on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can find us at Pod Clubhouse. Our DMs are always open, and we'd love to hear from you.